Ramon, not only for sponsoring this conversation, but bringing it to our center, his passion for intellectual inquiry. It's a blessing to have members who step up and lead by example, and our community is very grateful. Tonight's program speaks to a broader mission of this august institution. As adherents to the tradition of modern orthodoxy, we take a special interest in the relationship between our abiding fealty to our timeless and eternal halachic system and the ever-evolving wisdom of the wider world. As Rashi puts it so beautifully at the outset of our parsha this week, he says, "Ma'inyan shmita le'etzal har Sinai, ve'alo kol ha'mitzvos ne'amru mi'Sinai." The Torah tells us the halachos of shmita. It begins by introducing them with the notion that they were told to Moshe on Har Sinai. And Rashi asks, why would the Torah go out of its way to point this out? All the mitzvos were given at Sinai. Why mention this when it comes to Shemitah? And he says, "Elama Shemitah nemru klaloseya pratuseya v'tiktukeya misinai, af kula nemru klaloseya v'tiktukeya misinai." Rashi says we should think about it in the reverse. When it comes to Shemitah, not only were the general outlines transmitted at Har Sinai, but so were all the details and all the particulars. And so it is with every other mitzvah in the Torah. Our Masorah is so rich, so broad, and so encompassing that it paved the way to deal with questions that our grandparents once consigned to the realm of science fiction. What's left for us is to engage in the work of understanding both the wisdom of our Torah and the modern world with enough depth and enough sophistication to integrate them appropriately. We're privileged to have with us this evening two outstanding individuals who have agreed to share their expertise with us, one from the perspective principally of theory, the other more from the perspective of practice. Rabbi Jeremy Weider is the Joseph and Gwendolyn Strauss Professor of Talmud at Yeshiva University, a Rosh Yeshiva at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, an adjunct professor of Bible in Yeshiva College. He was ordained by Reitz and holds a PhD in Judaic Studies from New York University. He's a prolific scholar with over 500 lectures on Judaism captured on media and available online. Dr. Hannah Lippman is a geriatrician, a cardiologist, and a bioethicist. Since 2009, she has been the associate director of the Montefiore Einstein Center for Bioethics and chief of the Bioethics Consultation Service. Currently assistant professor of medicine, Dr. Lippman completed her medical education at Columbia University and her internal medicine residency at the University of Michigan. Her cardiology fellowship was at Tufts and Mount Sinai. She completed the Integrated Geriatrics and Palliative Care Fellowship at Mount Sinai as well, and she's a graduate of the Montefiore Einstein Certificate Program in Bioethics and Medical Humanities. I'm going to ask each of our guests to share some opening thoughts. First, more broadly, about their respective approaches to the ethical questions surrounding end-of-life issues, and then specifically on the topic of organ donation. I'm going to then ask them a couple of questions, and in the time remaining, we'll open it up to our audience, and we'll have you out by 9:15. Okay, maybe 9:30. It's my pleasure now to turn over the program to Dr. Hannah Lippman. Thank you.
That lovely introduction, and thank you for having me here. And I always say after hearing all of those things that I'm very good at taking exams and giving money to the American Board of Internal Medicine. I think I'd start by telling you a little bit about the clinical bioethics service that I run at Montefiore, because it's something that many people may not have any experience with, and talk a little bit about what it means to practice bioethics at the bedside. So at clinical service, somebody once asked me if I just sit in an office waiting for people to call me and ask me difficult ethics questions. And I said, yes, that's basically what I do in my ethics work. We are a service that is available to anybody in the hospital throughout the Montefiore Einstein network. Anybody can call us. Unlike when I'm being called as a cardiologist, where it's really the patient's attending physician or primary physician that makes the call to call me in on a case, anybody, the attending physician, the nurse, the respiratory therapist, the family, the patient, him or herself, can call and say, something doesn't feel right to me. And I need some help thinking through something that I think is an ethics problem. So that's one wonderful thing about the service, is that we're really available to anybody. And I don't have a preconceived notion when I'm helping people through ethics issues in patient care about what an ethics issue should be. I think it's enough that somebody is struggling with a decision that they're facing. Primarily it is clinicians who call us, nurses, doctors, physician assistants, and the clinical team. But as I said, we do get calls from patients and family themselves. The kinds of questions that were asked, a lot of things that we'll touch on some of the, from a more theoretical perspective tonight, a lot of end-of-life questions. What is the appropriate treatment for my loved one who's facing critical illness, who may die, doesn't want to, but may? Is it wrong if I say, I'm sorry, I don't think that treatment is right for her, right for my mother? We also get questions, very profound questions, about how to take care of patients who can't speak for themselves and have nobody. And those are really profoundly sad cases when people have outlived everybody who once knew them or loved them, and we're faced with saying, you know, for the most part, my work is about trying to make sure that the tools of medicine are used to further each patient's values, and trying to put together what's possible from the medical arena with what should be done from the perspective of that patient. But when we have patients who have nobody to speak on their behalf, we're left with wondering, how do we know what this person would have wanted? How do we know what their values are? What's in this person's best interest without us knowing them? So we get a lot of questions like that. We get a lot of questions about patients who are refusing a particular recommended treatment, which I call here's what we're selling, you don't want what we're selling. And we have to figure out why that might be. Why aren't we on the same page with the patient, him or herself, about whom the care is really, you know, for? Why are we not on the same page? So we get other sorts of questions like patient confidentiality, when is it right to share a person's information? We do get some questions about clinicians who don't think a particular treatment strategy is the right thing to do, perhaps things we'll get into later about removing life-sustaining treatment. So that's what we call provider conscientious objection. It's not within their moral code, but it may be what's right based on what the patient wants. So we get those sorts of questions. And we have a very practical approach. Most of the people who do this work at Montefiore are clinicians and bioethicists. Like, I'm a physician, we have nurses who do it as well. And we're really about, yes, deliberating ethics questions in sort of the grand scale, in a timeless way, what is morally right and wrong. But really, at the end of the day, we're also about helping people make the decision in front of them. And we're very practically oriented. Some of the techniques that we use to help people through these kinds of decisions is a lot, first and foremost, a lot of conflict resolution, which I find very interesting. As you might imagine, whenever there's a question about what the right thing to do is, there's often people on different sides of the question. People may agree about something that's not morally right, but that often doesn't rise to the level of being called as a question to an ethics service because there's nobody to say, wait a second, we disagree here. So we do a lot of conflict mediation, which is a lot of fun, and deal a lot with, as you might imagine, these timeless ethics questions are always happening when they're happening at the bedside. In the thick of a web of people who are grappling with the serious illness of somebody they love. And so we deal a lot with the emotional realities that go along with that. People don't often make decisions through a process of sort of rational analysis when it's about somebody they love. So we help people feel supported and heard and help people come to consensus around a particular question. In that setting. And that's actually one of the most rewarding parts of the work, is helping, people when it's one of the most important times in their life when their loved one is facing, serious illness or serious questions. We're busy, so every hospital, I get asked this a lot, does every hospital have such a thing? Every hospital has to have a way of dealing with ethics issues that come up. It's a requirement for accreditation from the hospital accrediting body. But every hospital doesn't have exactly what we have. It's a very, cardiology pretty much looks the same everywhere. Maybe some places have some more fancy equipment. You know, they can do more fancy surgery than a community hospital. But it basically looks the same. Ethics looks very different depending on the place. There's lots of different approaches to helping patients and families and clinicians solve ethical dilemmas at the bedside. We happen to have an approach, like I said, that's very practically oriented. We also, traditionally, many hospitals have used an ethics committee, and that, you know, these questions are put to a committee of people. And some hospitals in New York City use that method. We tend to work in small teams or alone, because again, we have this very sort of interpersonal conflict resolution approach to these questions, and it's very hard to do that sort of work, supporting people through difficult decisions, from the, if we were up on a stage of the committee. So we tend to kind of get in the weeds, I like to say, with people. And the reason why that is all ethics is to, like I said, that our business is about making sure that all of the stuff that's possible in medicine is used to further that particular patient's goals and values. And there's a lot that goes into that. It's understanding, what treatments can do for this particular person, what somebody has to go through in order to achieve their goal, helping them define their goals. And that becomes especially poignant at the end of life, which is a number of the issues that we're here to talk about tonight. We happen to be a particularly busy service. We have about 200 calls like this a year. And I'm very grateful to have a wonderful team working with me, because I couldn't do all of that myself. And we also work on policy issues and systems issues in the hospital. But I just wanted to kind of set the stage for explaining what clinical ethics is at the bedside, and explain a little bit about what we do. And I'm going to talk about these issues from that perspective.
I approach this issue with a trepidation for two reasons. Number one is that the topic is a very extensive and complex topic, and the time frame in which to do it is a little bit short. So I'm going to try to touch upon what I think are some of the major points from a halachic, from a Jewish legal perspective. The second reason I have great trepidation is that this is one of those topics that is extremely difficult to approach from traditional rabbinic norms. The issues that are in play, both at the end of life and right after life, in questions for organ donation, are issues that basically didn't exist until 50 years ago. Until 50 years ago, no one was concerned about taking organs that wasn't organ donation. And so therefore, the time of death was really when a person stopped breathing, shortly thereafter you knew they were dead, and that was it. And even in terms of the ability to prolong life in a greatly reduced state was nowhere near advanced as it is today. Before, maybe a little more than 50 years ago, but before you had respirators and things of that nature, basically when a person was unable to function in sort of the normal way that human beings function when they're basically healthy, that marked sort of the inevitable rapid decline and death. And so the question of prolonging life in a situation of great suffering and what kinds of treatments and interventions were needed were really sort of almost academic, because you did whatever you could if you knew what was making the patient sick to heal them, and if not, you would do what you could to make them as comfortable as possible. But because of the advent of technology, all these questions have become much more complex. And in light of that, the traditional rabbinic sources simply don't address the question. But yet the way, typically speaking, Jewish legal decisors post can work is by turning to the classical sources and trying to tease out principles. It's difficult to tease out principles when the possibilities were simply never envisioned by the authors of these texts. That said, pretty much almost the entire legal discussion of end-of-life issues takes its found in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, one very short section in Yeridea, which has five very short laws of how you deal with a patient who is on their deathbed, where death is imminent, what is referred to as a goses, someone who is in the throes of death. We might define it for the moment as someone, today we would define perhaps someone whose death is imminent within 72 hours. That is basically the entire discussion. And what emerges from that, fundamentally speaking, is that you cannot do anything to actively hasten the death of the patient. But if there's something that is preventing the patient from dying naturally, one may remove that. That's basically mostly what we have to work with. And it's really from those sources that, and perhaps a few other Talmudic sources, which may or may not be relevant depending upon your perspective, that we attempt to sort of tease out what are the principles involved. The issue that I want to start to address is the question of when to stop treatment, or when is one obligated to continue to provide treatment. The premise of the discussion begins with the assumption that there is an obligation upon a physician to heal, and it's not only upon a physician, but presumably a physician is the one with the expertise. There is a prohibition of los samod al dam reyecha. One is not allowed to stand by idly while his fellow person is dying. And there's an obligation of hashavas aveda, the return of a lost object, which includes returning a person's health. If it entails returning a person's property, certainly restoring their health, as the rabbis understood. So that clearly, there is some type of obligation. The question that one, now if that one were to take that at face value, then one would argue that under all circumstances, one would simply do whatever one could to prolong life. There is a well-known principle in Jewish law, Chayei Sha'ah, that even short-term life has value, which is why the Talmud states that if a person has been trapped in a building that collapsed, so we are allowed on Shabbos to desecrate the Shabbos in order to try to save them. And even if we uncover them and it turns out they are going to die imminently, we can continue to desecrate the Shabbos, even if it means only giving them a few more hours of life. So certainly, given this principle of Chayisha, one might reach the conclusion that one must, under all circumstances, take all types of measures, including heroic measures, to extend life. The question that one has to ask is that, is there a notion of quality of life in Jewish law? And this is not really a simple question to answer. There are certainly Talmudic stories, agadot, which hint to such a possibility. I'll mention just one. The story is told of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasih, Rabbi Judah the Prince, who had terrible intestinal disease, and his students were engaged in intense prayer to save him, and as long as they were engaged in prayer, the angel of death was unable to take his soul. His very wise maidservant, she was very famous, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasih's Shifcha, so she did not like this. She saw how much he was suffering, and she went up to the rooftop and she dropped a flower pot and made a loud noise that distracted the students. They stopped praying, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasih's soul was able to depart. Now this is a case where she obviously didn't kill him directly, but she did everything in her power in order to allow him to die. And the question one might ask is, well, weren't his students correct? If they could preserve his life and lengthen his life, even for a short time, even if he was suffering intensely, would that not be worth it? So apparently, it would seem that at least there seems to be a strain of thought that believes that quality of life does matter. In fact, halakha recognizes the notion that one is supposed to visit a sick person, and one of the reasons one is supposed to visit a sick person is in order that they should pray for the person. But you don't always pray for the same thing. Sometimes you pray that the person should live, and sometimes you pray that the person should die. The question is really, under what circumstances then is it permissible to stop treatment? And we have to talk just for a moment also, a little bit later, about what types of treatment. And there, as far as I can tell, are two basic positions in Jewish law. There are those who believe that until the person reaches the stage of goses, until really if the medical experts assume that the person has 72 hours to live, then basically all treatments must be undertaken, no matter how heroic, if they entail lengthening the patient's life, even if it is just chayesha, and even if the patient is suffering in the process. Only when one reaches this really final stages, then one is not obligated anymore to take heroic measures. The argument conceptually underlying this position is that we are obligated to lengthen life at all costs, but we are not obligated to lengthen the dying process. And the dying process really comes at the way, way end of life. The second position is that the fact the quality of life does matter. And therefore, even before the period, the stage of goses, before that final stage, one has to weigh how much life will be lengthened versus how much suffering is going to be experienced by the patient. Now, one side note here, and this is one of the very difficult things, and I think Dr. Lippman talked about this a little bit, Now, halacha fundamentally doesn't recognize, let's say, family members deciding on behalf of the patient. If the patient is lucid and is able to speak for him or herself, so then obviously that provides us with a sense of whether the patient would prefer to live longer suffering or would prefer to be allowed to die. If the patient is unable to answer the question, from a strict legal perspective, there's no single person who has some type of power of attorney in order to decide that. It really has to be determined sort of what do we think the patient would want, which might depend upon what most people would want under those circumstances, but it becomes very, very complicated. But nonetheless, the assumption is that if we can determine that the patient would prefer not to live with suffering, then we would in fact have to honor the patient's request. The one very interesting story which sort of points to this idea of the patient's autonomy is a story about the city of Lod. Apparently, in the city of Lod, once upon a time, the angel of death had no domain, so all the inhabitants in Lod would live forever. But eventually people got very old and decided they didn't want to live anymore. So what they would do is they would step outside the city, and then the angel of death could take their soul, which is a very interesting notion. It certainly speaks to the notion of that not all life is worth living, and not in all circumstances is one obligated to make the effort to continue to live. The question in this case, though, in a situation where it's been determined that the quality of life dictates that, or the patient has indicated that he does not or she does not desire to live any longer under this great degree of suffering, what can be withheld? Now, the general consensus is that food and hydration and perhaps a ventilator would be required. Those are considered basic aspects of living. They're not considered heroic, and therefore one would be obligated to provide them under all circumstances. The question is, what about medications and other types of procedures? And from this particular standpoint, those who believe that quality of life matter would say that one is allowed to stop treating at that particular point, and would say that even though it's clear that this disease, or not failing to treat it, will lead inevitably to the patient's death and faster, that would be acceptable. So those really are sort of two schools of thought. I don't know what the general practice is among clinicians, and obviously may vary upon different faiths. I think this issue exists within Jewish law. I think Catholicism, for example, has a very different view on this issue. The one last question, very important issue, is one of patient autonomy. Under circumstances where Jewish law would perhaps dictate that we continue treating the patient, what about if the patient refuses? And I think that from a purely principled perspective, we would say that it doesn't matter, that the patient is not allowed to kill him or herself, and that from the perspective of being obligated to save life and to prolong life when the halacha requires it, it really shouldn't matter what the patient's requests are. Just as we're not permitted to assist the patient in committing suicide actively, we also can't do so passively. It is, however, clear to me, perhaps among the two greatest decisors in the previous generation, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, both indicated that a patient who was conscious should not be forced against their will to accept treatment if they really refuse. Certainly, we should attempt to persuade the patient that it would be appropriate to continue such treatment, but never forcing them against their will. Why is somewhat complicated, but that seems to be the consensus. I would just conclude by talking about just a couple more comments about the end of life. Once we have reached the end of life, and for all opinions, certainly within the last 72 hours, One distinction is always very carefully preserved in Jewish law, which is the difference between active hastening of death and passive hastening of death. Anything that is done actively to hasten death is considered fundamentally an act of murder, even if the patient is terminally ill. Whereas something that is done passively is typically what we permit. Secondly, it seems to be the consensus that one should obviously give palliative care, and that pain medications may be administered, even though it's possible as a side effect they may hasten the death, as long as the goal in doing so is not to hasten the death, but simply to relieve the pain of the patient. I would close with one story which I think illustrates the complexity of these kinds of issues. There was actually a long article written by Rabbi Gleich in the very recent issue of Tradition, summarizing the views that deal with one very difficult Talmudic story, which highlights our difficulties in figuring out what, in fact, Jewish law tells us about end of life. The story is told of the martyr, Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan, who was being burned by the Romans. And they wrapped him in a Sefer Torah, and they set it on fire, and they put a sponge of wool on his heart to slow the fire a little bit, to prolong his death. His students said to him, Rebbe, open your mouth so the flames will enter and kill you. He said, better that they kill me, but I do nothing to kill myself, nothing to hasten my own death. Suggesting certainly that any kind of active intervention to hasten death would be prohibited. But then the executioner turns to Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan and says, you know, would you like me to take the wool off your heart and to make the fire bigger? And Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan says, yes. And the executioner says, will you promise me that you will bring me to the world to come and get me a share there if I do so? And Chanina ben Trajan says, yes. At which point, so he's basically instructed this person to actively hasten his death, to murder him, and that seems to be okay. And after the executioner does so, the executioner himself then leaps into the fire. And then a voice comes out of heaven and says that both Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan and his executioner have entered into paradise, have entered into the world to come. So that story, I think, sort of encapsulates in some ways the difficulty we have in dealing with these issues, because we're really not sure what course to take and exactly how things should or play out in terms of halacha.
That was a wonderful laying out of all the different issues that come up in end of life. I knew I was making the right choice when I said, you lay out the issues and I'll respond. I have a much easier job now. I want to say a number of things about those issues. One is, I love the story of the praying students and the flower pot. I've heard that story before, of course. And I always wonder, one of the ways I look at it in terms of what I talked about before, about loved ones, you know, suffering because their love, you know, the person they love is sick and suffering, is, why are these students praying for him to live if he's suffering so badly? What kind of distress are these students facing at the loss of their beloved teacher? And what is going on in the mind of his assistant or his care person who drops the flower pot and says, you know, I'm going to be strong and I'm going to help him stop the suffering? And I think those kinds of perspectives are played out every single day in intensive care units and in hospitals. The struggle of loss and grief, and how to make decisions what's best for somebody when they're dying. So I love that story for that perspective, too. I don't know if I'm mangling it from a legal perspective. I want to say a number of things. One is also about the notion of goseis. And it says, one of the nice sentences that you said is, you know, if the medical professionals think that the person is dying within 72 hours. And I know that there are some medical professionals in the audience who will agree with me, I hope, that that is not always easy to determine. And one of the struggles that I see when I help clinicians and patients and families deal with these issues is prognosis. How do we know who's dying? Sometimes it's extremely clear who's dying, but oftentimes it's not. And there's a lot of uncertainty in medicine. I wish it were so easy to say this person falls into this category or that category. And I think that kind of uncertainty leads people to struggle with these issues. So the perspective that we would take from a secular point of view about whether it's right to withhold treatment or to do like what we call life-sustaining treatment to preserve life, or to take a more comfort-only oriented approach, is sort of what we would call in secular bioethics a benefits burden analysis. What does somebody have to go through, and what are they going to get out of it? And people's values come into that because they weigh those things differently. Some person might say, I'm diagnosed with cancer, and I hear that there's a course of chemotherapy, and I have a 50% chance of cure, but that course of chemotherapy is too burdensome. That's not what I want to go through. And if it is a 50% chance of cure, is also a 50% chance I'll die. And if there's a 50% chance I'll die, I don't want to go through that. I want to live, whatever. I'd rather get a 100% chance of death with a better quality of life. So that's how we would approach it from a secular point of view. What do you have to go through? What do you get out of it? And how do you weigh those benefits and burdens? And the fundamental value you also touched on is the notion of quality of life. What is a life worth living? And one of the, and certainly in secular bioethics, we have a much greater role in the last 40, 50 years for patient autonomy, that everybody has sort of the right to decide what to them is a life worth living. Some of the most difficult questions in bioethics are the ones where people make decisions that their life is not a life worth living when most of us don't agree. And one of the fundamental questions that comes up is, how sick do you have to be before we'll let you die of something we could otherwise cure? So we would say, they used to call pneumonia the old man's friend, because it would, if he died of pneumonia, he wouldn't have a prolonged functional decline until death. But now, pneumonia is something we can save you from. You know, we can give you antibiotics, so unless it's a pretty bad pneumonia, we can save you from it. And at what point does somebody's notion of their own quality of life become so diminished that they say, no matter what, if you could say that, I don't want what you've got. But that's what I call getting in the weeds, and the fun part in sort of secular bioethics is to try and figure out what somebody's own notion of a life worth living is. And we get tripped up in quality of life, with quality of life concerns a lot in secular bioethics, because we all bring our own biases and ideas and values and religious views and moral understanding of what life is and what our responsibility is to preserve it. Another one of the fun things is that people don't walk around, I like to say this to my students, people don't present their values on a silver platter. They don't say, this is what a life worth living is to me. They tell you who they are, and they tell you stories about themselves, and then it's up to the team, and sometimes a bioethicist, and sometimes caring clinicians, to understand what that means for them and help people choose the treatments that further their own goals and values. So we think a lot about quality of life from that perspective. And the last thing I'll say is, well, two more things, this notion of surrogate decision-making. That's the sort of broad area of ethics where people are deciding on behalf of patients who can't decide for themselves. And it's interesting to hear that there really is no legal foundation for that in Jewish law. There's many places in Europe, for example, I happen to know that Switzerland only a few years ago passed a law saying that families could make decisions on behalf of incapacitated loved ones. So it's not historically the norm that families had as much of a role in decision-making on behalf of incapacitated loved ones as we do here. But because of the complexity of the distress that loved ones face, like the praying students, surrogate decision-making is a very interesting area of bioethics, helping not only families articulate the values of loved ones, but be supported as part of the unit of care, as people to whom this illness is happening, even though they're not the sick one, because they are the people who love the sick one. And then I'll just say one other thing about active and passive, and you didn't define those exactly, so how you define active and passive is very important if there's a distinction between active and passive. We wouldn't make that distinction in quite the same way in secular bioethics. The way active and passive usually plays out as a notion is it morally right to, say, take a ventilator, a machine with a tube in somebody's throat to breathe for them? That's an easy sort of treatment to talk about. And you had mentioned that a ventilator is part of what you would withhold. That was one of the treatments that might be obligatory. And in secular bioethics, nothing that's considered a medical treatment is absolutely obligatory. We would say that it depends on the values of the patient, the benefits and the burdens in the context of the patient's prognosis. What are they going to get out of it? What do they have to go through? It sounds like if active and passive translates into withdrawing or withholding, that you might make a distinction between saying somebody who keeps seeing somebody say that older man with pneumonia who we could save with antibiotics, maybe he can't breathe on his own. And there's a difference between never putting him on the ventilator and saying you wouldn't want that. His quality of life is diminished in his own eyes, and he would rather be treated with comfort only. Versus putting somebody on a ventilator and then later saying, take away the ventilator. So we don't make a distinction between those two decisions in secular bioethics. And a couple of, oh, just want to elaborate a little bit on why. First off, when you're a clinician recommending a course of treatment for a patient, what you omit is just as important as what you give. It's about the whole plan of care, not only what you do to somebody. So not doing something, not offering chemotherapy to somebody with a 50% chance of cure is just as profound a decision as to give chemotherapy. So this sort of it's a little bit of an artificial distinction from a medical decision-making point of view. I acknowledge definitely that there's different emotional ways of thinking about deciding never to put somebody on a ventilator versus taking somebody off of a ventilator. But it falls out on both sides. I think there are people for whom taking somebody off of a ventilator feels like they're killing somebody. You take them off, and if they couldn't breathe without it, it may be a minute, it may be a few hours, it may be a few days, but that person may die without the ventilator. That's why we were treating them with it in the first place. We would say in secular bioethics that the person is dying of their underlying disease, that their condition, their pneumonia or whatever else caused them not to be able to breathe, is what they're dying of, and that we're removing an impediment to death and allowing them to die of their disease, which is not the same as actively giving something to cause somebody's death. So there's that emotional aspect of doing something that then, you know, appears temporally, you know, in time related to their death. But there's also, I think, an emotional way to not doing something. And I see patients and families and doctors and clinicians of all kinds sometimes say, well, you know, there's clinical uncertainty here. So we take our friend with pneumonia. Well, maybe he would be willing to go through, you know, a week of being on a ventilator in an intensive care unit with intravenous antibiotics if it meant that he could have the same, what he would consider his quality of life. But if it meant prolonged time on a ventilator or that he would not come back to his enjoyment of his usual activities, he wouldn't want it. But I, as the doctor, can't say ahead of time. I don't know. Sometimes you do know which course it's going to take, but sometimes there's a lot of uncertainty. And one of the useful tools when there's a clinical uncertainty is what we would call a time-limited trial. We'll try the ventilator. We'll see if it supports you to achieve your goals. But if it doesn't, we'll take you off. So I would hate to see somebody not start it because there was a prohibition against stopping it when there was a chance that they could achieve their goals with it. So sometimes it's harder not to start something because you never know what could have happened. Maybe they could have survived. And it's also hard to withdraw something. So there's the emotional reality and then the sort of bioethics analysis.
Respond to one thing.
Sure. Let me ask our reader to respond, and then we're going to pivot to organ donation.
Just that distinction in terms of I think the general view is that there is a difference between not putting a patient on the ventilator versus removing an active and passive, but not everybody agrees to that. But over that concern, one of the suggestions that was made by Rabbi Lezer Waldenberg, the author of the Tzitz Eliezer, I think he was the medical advisor for Shari Tzedek, was that they should, when they're not sure when a patient comes in, they should put them on a ventilator with a timer, you know, which automatically shuts off after a certain amount of time. So if they think that at that point it's really not helping, they don't have to do anything to remove it. So yes, I understand that from a secular perspective, you know, it looks no different not putting them on the ventilator versus putting them on a ventilator, but that distinction of active and passive is a very technical legal distinction in Jewish law that covers many areas of Jewish law, not just this area, and that was the solution that was suggested. The suggestion was made when doctors were concerned about putting a patient on the ventilator and then not being able to take the patient off because that would be active, was to set it on what we call the Shabbos clock, that's the term we use, for a certain amount of period of time, a couple of hours, 12 hours, and then it would automatically, the ventilator would go off on its own, and then you can make the decision then whether to put the patient back on the ventilator or whether you didn't want to do so. So you gave the physicians, even though removing from the ventilator, shutting the ventilator, or taking it away from the patient would be considered active and always prohibited, you basically used the technology so as to allow the doctors the option passively to take the person off the ventilator.
Okay, so there's a lot here, but I want, before we start to run out of time, let me just ask you an easy question, Rabbi Wiener, and that is, should everyone in this room fill out an organ donor card? Or shouldn't they? Why yes, why no? And then maybe ask Dr. Lippman to respond.
Okay. But I'll get to talk 5 minutes about that anyway. The answer to that question is yes. Everybody should fill out an organ donation card. The only question is which organs you indicate that you wish to donate. Fundamentally speaking, will it be all organs or will it be just kidneys and corneas? And that issue depends upon what is determined to be the definition of death in halacha. Generally speaking, if one has to wait for cessation of the heartbeat, even after, let's say, brain death, so then usually only the kidneys and corneas can be used. If one defines halachic death as full brain stem, complete brain death, then it is possible to take other organs as well. So I won't tell you which box or which set you should check, but I think that everybody should be signed up as an organ donor.
Okay. You want to comment, and then I'll go back.
I would say there's no prohibition for anybody to be an organ donor, and since the concept of brain death is established in secular bioethics and medicine, you can donate whatever is, you know, technically possible. And certainly, you know, with thousands and thousands and thousands of people waiting to be organ recipients of transplants, then I would encourage people to be an organ donor. One of the hottest topics in organ donation recently in New York was whether we should go from an opt-in system, which is the system that we have to say you have to sign up to be an organ donor, to an opt-out. Everybody's presumed to be an organ donor, and unless you say you don't want to, you can perhaps address that in questions if that's interesting to people.
So let me just follow up, Rabbi Weider. It's a big issue, but maybe you could just say a few words about it. As you mentioned, there are Jews who would have the position that there's a much narrower berth when it comes to organ donation, specifically if they accept a definition of death that requires the cessation of the heartbeat. So from a policy perspective, what's our response to people who have a strong moral reservation about donating organs but have no compunction about receiving them if ever that situation should arise?
I am deeply troubled. There is certainly a strain of thought amongst some of certain decisors who've written on this issue, who see no problem regarding harvesting the organs as murder, but nonetheless allowing a patient to receive them because they're taking the organs anyway. I have great difficulty with that. I believe that if one believes that removing the organs is murder, then one should not take the organs, even if it means dying. And the basis, from a legalistic perspective, I understand what the opposing opinion is, but I believe that the opposing opinion is that you're not doing anything. The worst thing you're doing is you're violating what we call the thing. Either you're putting a stumbling block before the blind or encouraging somebody to violate something. And while you're obligated to give up your life, not to murder someone else, but if you're only violating this prohibition of the Shneiver, then we don't say that you have to give up your life. But I would say in response that the real reason, if you actually analyze, the reason why there are three cardinal sins which one does not violate in order to save one's life is not because of the sins themselves, but because of the profound desecration of God's name, the Chilul Hashem. The Rambam writes that if a person under duress commits murder to save his life or worships idols and the like, he hasn't violated that avera because he's under duress, but he has desecrated God's name, and that's why you give up your life. And I believe that anybody who would say that I won't give the organs but I'll take is profoundly desecrating God's name, even before they're in that situation. And therefore, I think it is just morally and halachically an untenable position. If you don't want to, if you believe it's murder, you don't give, then you have to accept and accept.
Well, I'll just say that sort of the flip side of that was one of the issues that came out in this opt-in versus opt-out, because we don't have universal health care, so that if you have an opt-out system where you presume that everybody's an organ donor, then people who did not have access to be recipients of organ transplants because they did not have health insurance would then be obligated to donate. So it's sort of the flip side of the same thing, and that was sort of morally repugnant to people, and it didn't pass the legislature, and actually the state medical bioethics committee advised against opt-out for that reason. And until we have universal coverage, it's not fair. There's no justice in requiring people to donate if they couldn't be organ recipients.
So, Dr. Lumen, let me just circle back to something that that you said earlier. For many of us sitting in this room, the position that Rabbi Weider articulated about the principles that we try to tease out from our tradition resonates with us, because that is how we engage in the halachic process. What I think is harder for people in this room to come to grips with is how a secular bioethicist sets out his or her first principles. And while from an abstract or philosophical perspective one can say well, we want to do what's in the best interest of the patient. We want to understand his or her values and try to further the goals of that person to the best we can understand them. Are there any sacrosanct principles which are inviolable? Are there any first principles which you always come back to, or is it always circumstance dependent?
Excellent question. So I would say that there's you can look at it as a continuum between things being very circumstance dependent, because really the facts on the ground dictate what's possible. But I think also what you're asking sort of two questions, I think, the way I hear it is, does secular bioethics have foundational principles? And also, how does one who doesn't, a person who's facing these decisions, who doesn't take their moral guidance from Jewish law, get their moral guidance? The second question I can't answer. I mean, that's a very profound question about what does it mean to have a moral guide in one's life. I can answer it from the point of view of a bioethicist trying to help people further their own goals, which is to say that when we judge somebody's capacity to make decisions, they have to have a coherent value system. And if they're, if they say that the radio is telling them to do something, we would say that is not a rational reason. And when we judge somebody's decision-making capacity, we do judge their reasons, and it can be subjective and difficult. But in the world of secular medicine, we have to have room for the various moral traditions and beliefs that people come to us with. I just had the opportunity to speak to bioethicists from a Scandinavian country where most of the people in the country have the same moral system. It's an entirely different way of being than in the Bronx, when people come with all sorts of traditions. So we sort of get into it, like I said, from the angle of capacity, where we would say, is that a coherent moral system? One of the very profound ways that that comes in is Jehovah's Witnesses, who do not believe in blood transfusion. So whereas somebody has having a profound bleed, I would have no question that I would say, transfuse me, save my life. And certainly blood transfusion not being considered a traditionally burdensome treatment, it sounds like Jewish law would say you're obligated to take that blood transfusion. If you're a Jehovah's Witness, your tradition is you're obligated to refuse it. Now, of course, just like there are many ways of interpreting Jewish law and many kinds of Jews, there are many kinds of Jehovah's Witnesses, so I don't want to be making a blanket statement, but that's, the tradition. And that's a difficult place for a secular or anybody other than a Jehovah's Witness to accept, to see somebody die of something that's so obligatory in your own tradition. But we've decided as a society that that's their moral code, and that they have the right to do that. Now, certainly as a very process-oriented bioethicist, I would say we have to make sure that people don't feel coerced, that they're making the decision independently, not coerced by their church elders or their spouse or whatever, and that they understand the risks and benefits, and they're making the decision, rationally and thoughtfully. I will say that the second aspect of that question is, does secular ethics have foundational principles? The answer is yes. So we always start when we teach medical students, or anybody, about secular bioethics is sort of the mantra of the principles that are beneficence, the obligation to do good for somebody. Doctors have certain, all clinicians, but doctors especially, have certain fiduciary responsibility, and fiduciary responsibility to the patient. It's all in their interests, and we have an obligation to do good for them. And then the corollary for that is non-maleficence, which is do no harm. So there's an obligation to treat suffering and to not cause suffering, needless suffering. Patient autonomy is the third principle, that the rights of people, of capable people to decide what happens to their body is there. We have to honor the decisions of capable patients. I take a broader notion of autonomy than that, which is what I said before, that the tools of medicine, even as the tools of medicine are used to further that patient's values, even as spoken by a surrogate decision maker, even as interpreted by the clinical team. And then justice, that like situations are treated alike, that we don't discriminate based on unfair things, things like that. So that's a whole talk in and of itself, but those are sort of our foundational principles in secular bioethics.
Okay, let me ask the two of you one final question, and you've both said a number of very important and provocative things tonight, and I want to give the audience a chance to ask their questions as well. The last question I wanted to ask is this. You know, it's very heartening to see this room full of individuals who are interested in this conversation. But I would say on the whole, end-of-life issues, and to be blunt about it, talking about a death is very hard for people. And it's hard for us as a community to have these conversations in a constructive and healthy way. And my question to you is, do you have any advice for us? What more can we do as a synagogue, as a community, as people who care about these issues? What more can we do to help educate our members about a very important set of issues that are so very hard for people to talk about?
I'm not sure that I, in my experience, have much to say to this issue. Sitting where I sit, you know, thank God I deal almost exclusively with occasionally births for students of mine. You know, the only thing that I would say, and I don't know how much this helps, is that it's important to educate people before they're in that situation. It's very hard to do it when you're sort of facing, if you want to call it facing, the angel of death and his sword to sort of make those decisions. I think, regardless of one's position on halakha and how binding they are, I think it's a very good idea for patients to have, I guess they're called living wills. So at least we know people have the opportunity at a time when they're not feeling pressed to think about these issues, at least from a perhaps maybe not what they, it may not be what they would think at the end of life, but at least to start to think about the issues and to give some instructions so that if in fact they're not able to sort of make those decisions later, at least the, you know, the people around them have something, you know, which to do. But I think talking about it at a time when it's not a pressing issue, from my vantage point, would be a very helpful thing.
I agree. I'll say two words about what we would call advanced directives. And those are the tools that we have available to us to make sure that our values are known when we don't have, when we can't speak for ourselves anymore. And you mentioned the living will. A living will is basically an if-then statement. If this happens to me, then do this. Living wills, from the perspective of a doctor, are often very hard to interpret. They're often very sort of boilerplate. You know, there's a New York State, if you Google New York State living will, you'll find a kind of standard document. It's a good starting point, but I would say think about fundamental questions. What is a life worth living to you? How do you want your decisions made? Are you a person that wants that your, you know, foundational moral guidance is Jewish law, and you can, you know, describe something about your philosophy about that? That would be amazing. If I saw a living will that said, here's how I think about these issues, and this is why I'm saying in this situation, if I'm facing the end of life, then do this, that would be wonderful. It's often hard to decide. They often say, if I'm terminally ill or permanently unconscious, A, that's prognostically, you know, sometimes difficult to say, then do this. And we get into a lot of conflicts really on the ground about how to interpret those things, interpret living wills. So think about your process and values and articulating almost like a medical ethical living will would be wonderful. And then I will also say that in New York State, it's also important to have another type of advance directive, which is a healthcare proxy, which designates who you want to make decisions for you. In New York, if you don't have one of those, your family has the right to make end-of-life decisions, decisions about life-sustaining treatment, but only under certain circumstances, not under all circumstances. But if you want, if you know who you would want to be empowered to make decisions, including end-of-life decisions, under all circumstances, go ahead and name them a healthcare proxy. The other important setting to do a healthcare proxy is if there's no healthcare proxy, there's a standard legal hierarchy: spouse, adult child, then adult parent, then sibling, then everybody else. If you want to go outside that hierarchy, maybe have a spouse, but you'd rather your child child make the decisions or whatever, then name that person a healthcare proxy. Otherwise, the law will empower the person higher up on the hierarchy.
Okay, so let me just ask Rabbi Zirkin to come up to be available to pass the microphone around. I want to ask members of this audience if they have questions. Please speak clearly into the microphone, and of course, please articulate succinctly your question for our panelists. If it's directed to one or the other, let us know. Otherwise, we'll ask them both to respond.
Rabbi, you talk about the kinds of treatments. The normative is an extraordinary at the end of life. And if the normative lymphocytes and nutrition, you can't cut it off. It's constant. If you start an extraordinary method, can you cut it off?
So I think the answer would be, so I didn't elaborate fully, but I described what, the answer to the question say is no. In other words, if you regard cutting off something that's already being provided as opposed to as being active, then the answer would be under no circumstances may you do so. One of the interesting, in principle, the answer is no. That question, which I sort of made an assumption that removing the ventilator is called active, is a point that actually is not entirely clear. As long as it's some, in other words, that may be considered external to the patient. That's something that you alluded to. But I would say, I guess, in the consensus is that that is considered an active form, and the answer is no, one would not be able to stop it, even in those circumstances.
Jordan?
This question if you could, in a science fictional way, looking into the future, solve your biggest pain point, either as a rabbi or as a physician, what would be that solution? Maybe it would be stem cell organ growth. You grow your own organs. Or if you were up by God's strong enough idea, what would you like to know? What are your big pain points?
Okay, so I'll just try to sum up Jordan's provocative question. He said, essentially, if you could have anything you want in a science fiction kind of way, what would you go for? Good summary?
I have no idea. I would go for having all clinicians be gifted communicators.
I'm not sure I can answer that question. In theory, I would like to ask, I would like there to be clarity in Jewish law on some of these issues. But since we have a principle of lo bashamayim, that God doesn't get a vote, so that doesn't help. So I guess that maybe he would like to help rabbis get along with one another to reach a... maybe that would be a good solution.
If there were clarity,
we
wouldn't have job security.
Steve.
I had a question about living wills, healthcare proxies. Let's say that client patient signed a living will, and it was thoughtful, and it was something more than just a boilerplate. But essentially, they're saying no heroic measures, do not necessitate those sorts of decisions. And now the patient is ill, and really two different questions. One is now there is somebody who has a healthcare proxy and says, no, I really think that mom or dad or whomever would like some heroic measures taken. That's part one of the question. Part two of the question is that there is a living will, but there is a healthcare proxy, and one of the family members who's designated says, DNR, no heroic measures, and a lot of other family members are there talking, saying, no, mom really does want heroic measures.
So those are the bread and butter questions of my ethics practice. The first question is sort of the classic living will versus current surrogate decision maker. I'm not a lawyer, but I'll talk about my understanding of the law, but I'm not a lawyer, disclaimer.
Steve is.
Okay, good. you can catch me. And then ethically. So as I said, a living will is a document that comes to us from the past. You can't have a dialogue with a living will. You can't say to the living will, what did the person mean? Did they want it applied in this situation or not? And that's very difficult. And you have a real-time surrogate decision maker who has the advantage of being able to dialogue with the clinical team, to roll with the facts on the ground, to make the best decision with what's going on. So for a healthcare proxy, the law does not say which trumps. Always go with the living will, always go with the healthcare proxy. In the absence of a healthcare proxy, and I won't get very technical, but we have a law that's called the Family Healthcare Decisions Act that delineates how surrogate decisions are made in the absence of a healthcare proxy. And that law prioritizes patients' known wishes, including living wills, over the current surrogate decision maker. Now, I don't want the law to tell me which trumps, because you can imagine a situation where the patient really was very thoughtful and really didn't want those sorts of what you called heroic measures, and the healthcare proxy is the loving daughter in absolute distress who just can't do it, but it really was what the patient wanted. And that, you know, we would prioritize what the patient wanted with a lot of support and dialogue and care. For the patient's daughter, I would never say, "I know your father better," because here I have a piece of paper. I would always say, "You love your father. You know your father. Let's work on this together." But you could also imagine a situation, which I've had in real life, where the family read the person the document. She barely spoke English, third grade level education, from another country. She signed it, and then they were shocked to find out what it actually meant. And they wanted to make a different decision. So the devil is in the details always. You know, the facts on the ground really matter. But the law is different depending on whether it's a healthcare proxy or a next of kin designated by the Family Healthcare Decisions Act. And then from an ethics point of view, we would be very process-oriented. We would take a conflict resolution approach, try and gather the clinical team, the family, other people who know and love the patient, and say, let's learn about who this patient is. Let's set aside all this living will business for a minute. Let's learn about who the patient is. What are they facing clinically? What are the options? And how do we interpret what we know, taking into account the living will, but also this other information about what we know they would want at this moment? And then the second question is intra-family conflict. And again, people who love the patient matter, in my view, but a healthcare proxy matters more because they're specifically designated by the patient. Now, you know, our law is very rigid. It says you have to name one healthcare proxy and one alternate. That's not often the way families work. I often say I did not have a healthcare proxy while my father was alive because my parents were divorced. My father would never forgive me if I chose my mother, and vice versa. My father lost, he died, and now my mother is my healthcare proxy. This families work as webs of people, not only as one designated person. But sometimes the rest of the chattering class are the crazy people in the family, and the patient really wanted that one person. So again, the devil in the details trying to figure that out. But legally and often ethically, the healthcare proxy is the most important voice, but we would bring the people in the room and try and bring people to consensus and understand what the conflict was about. Not always possible. In the end, the healthcare proxy has the say. Does that answer your question?
Okay, we have time for one more question, and then we're going to wrap it up.
All right, sometimes things end up after either the proxy is not present or it's a paper that says that someone's a proxy or living will is not available, and things just happen really fast. The physicians have to make a decision, and they go by their code that you mentioned, that they're going to make a decision based on what they feel is medically appropriate. Now the family arrives, or whoever arrives, and they're like, "We don't want this. Like, we don't want this. We don't think the patient would want this." Is there a way, both halakhically and medically, that they could devise a plan
then remove things in a way that it would be halakhically permissible and both medically inappropriate? So from a halakhic perspective, as I indicated, I think earlier, it's not even clear to what extent, in theory, that we respect patient autonomy. In practice, we do. We're not going to force the patient against his or her will. But certainly, the halakha doesn't recognize other family members having any particular rights. At best, it would be deciding really what did we think that the patient wanted. But putting that aside, it doesn't. Once one has started the treatment, to the extent if one considers doing certain things at this point to be active, it doesn't really matter if it was a mistake. Even if we know now, we know with certainty that the patient didn't want it, we're still not allowed to actively hasten the patient's death. It wouldn't make a difference. It may have been a poor decision in the first place, but it would not be permissible to do anything, actively speaking, you know, actively to hasten their death.
I mean, in a secular bioethics world, if that were appropriate for the prognosis, the patient had a limited prognosis, or that their baseline functional status was repugnant to them within the quality of life, and we thought this was an ethically appropriate surrogate decision maker, and the clinical team thought it might, you know, be among the ethically appropriate choices, there'd be no... it depends a little bit on whether that person, the family, has a healthcare proxy or is just but the next of kin is delineated by this other law. But I won't get into that technicality. I can afterwards if you want.
Okay, let me just ask Rabbi Reeder and Dr. Lippman if they would, in the last 3 minutes, maybe leave us with a final thought if there's a piece of the conversation that you wished we'd gotten to but didn't. or if you have anything that you'd like to leave the audience with, let me ask you to do that.
I have just one last thing. I wanted to talk a little bit about the notion of the controversy about brain death, which, as I understand, is not a settled matter. There's scholars on both sides within the, scholars of Jewish law. In the medical world, in the secular medical world, brain death is an accepted clinical diagnosis of death, and somebody who meets the clinical criteria for brain death, cessation of whole brain function, as evidenced by a number of clinical tests, is clinically dead. I will say that these cases are tragic and very difficult, and as you know from me for the last hour, I'm very into saying that we need to support people through the difficult times in their life. And emotionally, brain death, whether you think legally or that the person is dead or not, certainly the person who meets the clinical criteria for brain death is very bad off and is certainly dying. If you don't accept the notion of brain death, that person is certainly dying clinically. And it's a very emotionally difficult state to be in for a loved one because we're used to what death looks like in a particular way. We may or may not have experienced it with somebody dying the sort of, a cardiac death, where the kind where we think of most commonly. But patients who are brain dead, who are hooked up to machines to keep their organs going, look very much not alive in some way, but they look the same after the doctor tells you that person has met the criteria for brain death as they did before. And no matter how you look at that legally, that's very troubling emotionally. So we do have cases that come to my bioethics service of families who, whose moral guide is Jewish law, who don't accept the diagnosis, and we have to work through that because medically they're dead, but from their point of view, the person is not dead, dying, but not dead. And there are also families whose moral guide is not Jewish law, who just, as I'm always saying, if somebody had given me the opportunity to put off the moment of my father's death, say, I would have taken it. So even, people from other religious backgrounds or, secular backgrounds, often have difficulty with that moment. So one of the things that my service does is to help work through that conflict. What, how do we take care of a family who is facing this?
I guess I would just close. We didn't really have the chance to focus so much on the question of brain death, but you raised it, so I want to make sort of two comments, one directly related to brain death. I don't adopt a particular position. I don't feel capable of sort of making a decision. But one point that I think should never get lost in the discussion about brain death is that the issue is not a medical or a scientific question. Medicine and science can tell you what state the patient's organs are in, what state their cells are in, what's functioning, what's not functioning, they can guess what the patient will or won't be capable of doing. The question of death is fundamentally a metaphysical one. We might define it as when the soul departs, but whatever it is, it's not fundamentally a medical question. It's really a values question, and depending on what one's values are, whether one is Jewish or Christian or Muslim or secular, wherever one derives one's values from, that's what will determine, in fact, the moment of death. In the case of Jewish law, the matter is still clearly not a settled issue, and I don't anticipate it will be settled anytime soon. But with that, I would sort of conclude by going back to one point earlier as an appeal to the importance of organ donation in our community. There's a fellow at YU who wrote a book recently, David Shabtai, about the whole brain death issue. And he had one suggestion that he thought would be a good idea in terms of my comment to him that the Chilul Hashem, the desecration of God's name, when observant Jews are happy to take organs but not give organs, he had the following suggestion, which I don't think ameliorates that, would be a great service to society, is that we should get every single Jew, Orthodox Jew, every Jew, every person to sign up to donate at least kidneys and corneas, because I think of the 100,000+ organs that people are waiting for in this country, something like 80,000-85,000 are actually kidneys. I don't know firsthand, but that's what he tells me. In which case, clearly, even though there's a very heated dispute over the question of all the other organs, since we could solve most of the problem on an issue that everybody agrees, it would really be appropriate that everybody in our community walk around with a card, at least that says that they're willing to give their kidneys, because that would really go, it might not get us into the end zone, but it would at least get us in field goal range, if we might put it that way. So.
Once again, I want to thank Hanno for making all of this possible. I want to thank Dr. Lippman and Rabbi Weider for their very thoughtful and provocative words. And thank you to all of you.